And unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning. I'm going to take this off. It's very hard to lecture with it on. I'm glad there's nobody new here. I think there's something, or Kelly, to cut out in making a remark like that. Yes, good morning. Because I want to talk about love and compassion and emptiness. And I can talk about it, but it's difficult, and it's difficult to make a lecture out of it. Because some of you know, at the last one-day sitting, I asked many of you in Doksan, what's love? And stunned you. And people gave various responses, but it was clear to them immediately and to me that they were responses from their heads or responses from their individual love relationships. And so everybody kind of went away agreeing that they would chew on it. So I'm interested to hear what may have fermented. And various other conversations have led me to think about it. Because I say in the text on the brochure something about, you know, that we sit down and get quiet and pay attention, and compassion grows from this. And I know what I mean, but I don't know that it's obvious. I think as you sit, it becomes clear, which is kind of my intention. I don't know how many of you have ever read the text of the brochure, or if so, how long ago? And as I have confessed before, I have a semi-allergic reaction to the words love and compassion because I think they're often used very glibly. Or well, glib will do. That people say, I'm going to be compassionate, or compassion is the thing, or we need more love. Well, yes, we do. But it's kind of a head thing. And I really do believe that it needs to grow out of emptiness. You don't stop at emptiness. You don't stop at letting go. You don't stop at seeing clearly. They go together. The love and compassion that I'm talking about is not as MLK said in the Riverside talk. He and I, we're not talking about that sentimental wash. What is it?
Love means never having to say you're sorry. I figure it's saying you're sorry all the time. Because you always hurt the ones you love. It's much deeper than that. And a bodhisattva compassion is I'm rejecting words like mindless or thoughtless, but it is mindless and thoughtless. It's not a brain event at all. It arises out of emptiness. It arises out of not seeing difference. It arises out of maybe you could say it's total empathy. And it has to arise out of self-love also, not narcissism, but a deep self-respect, a deep non-separation. You know, the Metta Sutta says you should love everybody like a mother or a parent loves a child. And so often we forget to include ourselves. You should love yourself as a parent loves a child. It's the base for a healthy sense of love. It's a healthy sense of self, I think. And it's not about self-involvement or narcissism, as I said. It's just when it's time to eat, you eat. When it's time to sleep, you sleep. When it's time to go running or go to the gym or whatever, you do that. When it's time to stop for a while, you do that. It's not about destroying yourself in the process. It's not about running yourself ragged. It's about what Dogen talks about in the instructions to the Tenzo. And the Tenzo Kyokuni says that you should have grand parental mind. And I'll tell you a story you may have heard before. I don't know, one of his disciples, one of the very senior ones, one of the ones we chant in the list of ancestors, Tetsu Gikai. Notice that he comes after Kōen Eijo. And Dōgen refused to give Dharma transmission to Tetsu Gikai because, Dōgen said, you don't have grand parental mind. You don't have that mind of love and generosity. And that's another useful word, generosity. In the movie, I guess the movie's called Zen, but it's basically a biography of Dogen. There's a brief scene at the when they're just starting a heiji. And a young monk is working in the kitchen, and he's preparing greens. And Tetsu Gikai comes by to check on him and say hello or whatever. And the young monk says he's doing okay, but it's hard because he's in the kitchen all the time. And he feels like he's not sitting enough, he's falling behind the other monks. And Tetsu Gikai says, well, maybe you should sit in the nighttime. Which, for God's sake, the kid needs to sleep sometimes. You know, he can't take care of the other monks if he can't do his work if he's totally sleep deprived. You know, and that scene just goes by. There's no comment on it or anything. But I think it really skewers Tetsu Gikai. That's how he was, just, you know, bully your way through it without regard to the humanity or the fact that, I mean, the young man might, you know, he might cut off a finger or something and burn himself badly or whatever if he were sitting all night and not sleeping. There has to be a balance between wholehearted effort, which is also talked about in that movie. I think that at one point, Ru Jing says, sit so hard you get a bloody ass. He didn't say ass, but anyway. And in the same essay in the Tenzo Kyokun that Dogen says that you must have a grand parental mind, a really loving, non-judgmental, open, generous mind. He also praises the Tenzo who comes to the ship to buy mushrooms, and I guess he walked like 30 miles round trip just to get mushrooms for a nice soup for the monks, or the one who is out in the courtyard drying mushrooms in the hot sun. And he says, why are you doing this in your old age? And the guy says, if not me, then who? This is my job. But I think often we get caught by the sort of emptiness side, the wholehearted effort side. Sit still. Turn towards difficulties. Be with them. Side. Though that one is in between, maybe. But at any rate, we forget the generosity side. We forget the compassion side. I do talk sometimes about people, I think, getting what I call stuck in emptiness. And they forget about the generosity side. You know, in Tassajara, I worked in the office one summer. It was wonderful. It's cool in there. That I worked with a number of other people. You know, you don't usually have at least two people in the office, and especially at times when the stage came in and, you know, a bunch of guests would come to check in or whatever. And there was one in particular who was a scholar and a very dedicated practitioner. And I have I love him. I have maternal feelings for him. And I watched when somebody would come in and ask if they could have an extra pillow, that person didn't come forward for them. You know, didn't say, oh, of course, go get one. Or respond in some way. I mean, I guess there were times when we couldn't, but just because there were too many people in the office, but most of the time it was not the issue. But there was just this, there wasn't this coming forward to meet the need. I don't know if there was some judgment about, you know, you should sleep on a block of wood. I don't think so. I think it was just being a little stuck. And I don't know, I never talked to that person about it. So I don't know if they would have been able to analyze it really or respond, but you know, and maybe there was some hesitance or fear of the connection or something. I don't know, but at any rate, I always thought of that as and still do it as being stuck in emptiness, and the too much emphasis on. I hate to say this, too much emphasis on knowing where the breath is every single second. You should know where the breath is. I do not take that back. But other things are also important. It's not like you have to choose. But you do need to, we need to balance. And for a bodhisattva, I think it is, it's just, I don't know, automatic will do. I tell the story of the people out in a boat, and a sea pirate boards their boat and says, I'm taking one of you, I need another oarsman. And the bodhisattva just gets up and goes. Bodhisattva does not say, take me, I'll go. And the four Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, and the Vasuddhimagga, it says that Buddha said, you're not my disciple if you say, take me, I'll go. Just go. And I thought recently of the example of a man named Isan Dorsey. I don't know if you know who he was. You probably heard the name. He is the subject of a biography called Street Zen. And Isan was somebody who had been a heroin addict, and he was a performer at a female impersonator, was what they called it back then, a nightclub called Finocchio's. It was on Broadway in San Francisco. And it was very, very popular with the tourists. At any rate, he had, in some ways, a really hard life. And somehow he came to Zen and Suzuki Roshi, and he loved Suzuki Roshi. And Suzuki Roshi loved him. And I'm going to tell a particular story, but I want to talk about him a tiny bit, because he really was, I only heard him lecture once at Green Gulch, and it was wonderful. He was at Tassajara for a while, and he really had a hard time at Tassajara because it's such a rigorous practice, and he really wrecked his body. So he couldn't always get up and so on, and he sort of did what he could, and Suzuki Roshi kept reassuring him that he was okay. And he was, later, he was the work leader at City Center. And he was obsessed with the floors. And he kept those floors, there's been tile floors, or maybe it's cement that's been marked and colored, but because they've been big, it's dark reddish brown. Anyway, he kept them shining. And Suzuki Roshi was so happy. One time he was, they were in the hallway, and Suzuki Roshi jumped on his back and gave him a big hug, because his son was kind of big and Suzuki Roshi was kind of small. And he just was so happy about the floors. Isan, as I understand it, was a person who stayed friendly with all of the various factions around the Baker debacle. And he didn't judge. He became the abbot and really the founder of the Hartford Street Zen Center in the Castro. And he wasn't, well, I don't know if this is perfect or not, but many people would say that this was not perfect. But when my friend Tia, she used to go and talk to him. And when she went, he would mix up a pitcher of martinis, and they would share martinis. That's not how Zen masters usually act. I like him a lot. I mean, just the idea of him. But what I wanted to say was the feeling of him, the love that came from him. And it just felt really natural. You know, it didn't feel like he was talking about something. I don't remember what the lecture was about exactly. And I know one thing he said that really touched me, but I don't know if it was in the lecture or in the discussion, you know, at Green Gulch. There'd be the lecture in the big zendo, and then there'd be a little break, and there were tea, and you could buy muffins, I think, or maybe they were free. Anyway, and then there would be a reconvening of anybody who wanted to in the what's called the Wheelwright Center up on by the deck there, and it was less formal, and you could ask questions, there'd be discussion, and it was a much smaller group. So I think he was talking about starting the hospice, not the Zen hospice that you may know of, but for a while there during the AIDS crisis, Hartford Street became sort of a hospice. And I don't know the relationship, it may have sort of spun off what's called the Maitri Hospice. At any rate, they started, and he talked about the first time, you know, they were caring for people, and people were staying there in order to die, or as they died. And Isan talked about the first time somebody shit himself, and he was it to clean it up. And you know, he never imagined that that was something that he was going to do. And then he just sort of took a breath and did it because it needed to be done. And you know, he was a little surprised that he survived. And I was very moved by that, the way he talked about it, that it was that his first response was, and then he just sort of said, okay, this is, I don't know what he said exactly, but you know, that's my fantasy. You know, this is part of being human. In the olden days, right, that's what happened with the younger people took care of the older people, and that's part of taking care of people. It moved me because I had had a similar experience with my father. He had MS, and came the point where he really could not you know, get onto the toilet and so on. And so there was like a bedpan, and then you had to wipe his ass and clean it up. And I did. And I remember the first time, and you know, if you'd asked me a week before, I would have said, no, I can't do that. But you know, you have to. And I would remind, this is mine, I would remind myself, oh yeah, my hands are washable. And it was hard and easy at the same time. But the way Isan described it, I thought, he knows, he knows. So I went and talked to him briefly after, you know, afterwards people were sort of milling around and I went up to him and I told him about that and that I was going to have to, I think I was about to go to Los Angeles and try to get my mother to give up driving. And or it was right after I did that and failed and so stole her car. And I just, it was so easy to talk to him. And I think I said, you know, I'd really like to come talk to you because that wasn't the time to have a long conversation. And he said, sure, but he just took me in his arms. I mean, I had never met him before, and it was the most natural thing in the world. And part of that, I think, sprang from his being comfortable in himself. No, there wasn't a feeling of separation. It was just the most natural response in the world of somebody talking about great pain and about a shared difficult experience. So he just opened his arms and he just held me. And then he continued very available, and we never did talk because we just kept, you know, not meeting in terms of times. And then my then teacher, Yvonne Rand, came back to town and whatever, so I figured I didn't need to bother him. But I'll never forget that. So what's love? What is love? Aside from the sentimental bosh. Zach?
I'll go first.
Or I shouldn't have said that.
Actually, I thought about it a lot, and I don't have a good answer. I keep trying to think of like definitions or something.
And the trouble is this fellow.
Yeah, and then I thought, I can't really describe it, and I'll add compassion to it too, although that one maybe is a little easier. But, and then I thought about, well, what does it feel like? But that's words too. I mean, that's, but I think, I maybe have a few versions. One is, you know, loving somebody or loving a movie, you just want it, more of it. You just want to be there. which in a weird way is the opposite of compassion, of I don't see having something as
yes.
part of compassion. Compassion is more, like you said, empathy.
Yeah.
But love is also, I think, giving up yourself for a person, let's say, or people. You know, I think of my family, I would do anything for them. and so that's a different kind of feeling. Although maybe it's just a different kind of thinking. So those are kind of some things I think about, but I really don't have a great answer for that. That isn't out of the dictionary kind of answer.
It is out of the dictionary. Well, at any rate, it isn't that, we're not, I'm not interested in the dictionary.
Yes, me neither.
And, but your first definition sounds a little raspy.
Yes.
So, keep sitting with it.
I do.
Stop thinking about it.
That's tricky.
Yeah. Well, you remember, I love this example, it was a while ago, you said, the difference is I hear the birds, but I don't listen to them.
No.
That's it. Steve?
For the recording, I already made a big gesture of like the entire world, and it includes myself. I don't want to objectify it and say it's a mirror, but it's like being a mirror. And yet the mirror can be a cold image, so I can't quite settle on that as an image. But it's like, to me, I'm sort of conflating love and compassion in what I'm speaking of, but what I work with and have been working with a lot more recently is everything that comes up is included. Everything gets compassion, everything gets curiosity, everything gets the attention that it needs. And somehow that message only recently sort of came to me. I was being very selective in my practice, even though the idea of Zazen is, and I've always taught it this way, is be open to everything. And be kind to everything that comes up. Well, you know, sometimes it's harder to practice that. So, I feel like words do kind of fail me, but maybe images are a little helpful. Like a still pond might be also a good image. And that the still pond includes the person, includes me, includes you as the still pond.
I like the gesture. How about this?
Yes.
Well, what I did is I did the big round opening of arms and then ended up hugging myself. That's for the, as you said, for the recording. Leo?
I was thinking of that term, stuck in emptiness, and I hadn't thought about it quite this way before, but like the description of someone where we use that term kind of sounds more like they're separating, where if there's some experience of emptiness, of dependent co-arising, then it's a relational experience.
Uh-huh.
And you, at the beginning of your talk, you kind of talked about it having to come from that place, emptiness. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to talk about. Cultivating. I'm kind of at a loss now, but that was the part that struck me.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I use it as a shorthand, and it is a lack of connectedness. Maybe it's not including yourself, and then from including yourself, I don't know if this is true, but I was going to say from including yourself, then that kind of parental, that kind of generosity can flow from there. I don't know. I like, it sounds good. It's interesting. Lisa?
When I when you asked that during the session to me, and I kind of fumbled with it during the Dokusan, and then I went to sit kind of very immediately, because I guess at the time I was sort of dealing with a complicated relationship, that complication in with a person that I do love, you know, and sort of like what arose immediately, not from my thinking mind, was, it surprised me what arose was endurance. This feeling of, but I don't mean like endurance, like, you know, like an endurance test, like running a marathon or something like that. I meant it felt more like a kind of power of, like lasting power, despite all of the kind of, you know, irritations and difficulties and entanglements that often happens with the people that we love the most. There is this sense of it, no matter what, this something that I guess is called love endures. And it also struck me that even this practice of Zazen has that quality of endurance. Like lasting. And now today during this talk, I'm thinking, well, you know, I need to include that sense of compassion, self-compassion in that too, because otherwise it sounds like too harsh. And so when you were talking just now, I was struck by, you know, when I was practicing with that, with Shambhala, with the other group, and that practice of Tonglen, which is, I don't know if people know what that is, giving, breathing in and sending out. You always start with yourself. So you start with yourself, then you move on to a person that you love, then you move on to a person that you feel fondness for, then you move on to a stranger or kind of a someone that you're sort of neutral towards, and then you move on to the difficult person, and then you move on to everybody. And I always thought, oh, you start with yourself because that's easiest, you know? And I thought, and the person that you love is easiest, but actually when I'm thinking about it now, it's actually not easiest yourself. It's the most, you have to start there. Otherwise, you have to start with yourself, with this self-compassion. Because otherwise, all these other kind of, entanglement, when I'm thinking of these difficult relationships that are love relationships, all the kind of entanglements that create all this other stuff that's like guilt and I, you know, if you don't start with compassion, there's no way to get moved past that, I think.
Yeah, and I see you, Steve, I just want to say, and then I think that's why he says grand parental mind rather than parental mind. Because grandparents are kind of removed, you know, and you can always, not always, but you can usually kind of give the kid back. But right. Also that you don't have to, you know, you could give the kid a piece of candy where the parents might never do that. But you can loosen the rules and love them, you know, not more unconditionally than their parents maybe, but in a different way. It's just a simpler relationship. Steve?
Yeah, I wanted to respond to what you said, Lisa. The one is that I remember the Dalai Lama saying something to the effect, I don't remember whether he said the West or America, but he said that people, outside of the East, have more self-loathing than he had ever imagined.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's actually harder for us in the West to start with ourselves in that kind of sitting practice. Mm-hmm. Second thing that comes up for me is that related to grand parental mind and having some distance, when I was at the intensive, Reb Anderson talked a lot about compassion in Zazen, and what he kept talking about was have compassion to this body mind. And I found that was very useful, because if I say I'm going to be compassionate to myself, then I've kind of already created this being and have preconceptions about what this self is. Who is Steve, and what does it mean to be compassionate to him? And maybe I act a little bit too much like a parent to myself. You know, I know it's good for myself, and that's what compassion is. But be compassionate to each body mind seemed very helpful, because if something comes up that I don't want to think about, or that I think that's not me, still be compassionate to this body mind that arises right here. So just wanted to offer that.
Thank you.
Oh, Marilyn.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to say exactly, but
oh, it's very hard.
Yeah, I feel like the self-compassion, I don't know, I probably barely touched the surface of that. And just what Steve was talking about in grandparent mind, I almost think, I don't know if this has to do with compassion, but it's like sometimes I need a parent mind with myself where I'm being more, yeah, you need to do this instead of indulging something. And sometimes it's grandparent mind where you kind of know, yeah, give yourself a break now. And then in terms of the bigger picture, I know I worked at a hospital, and it wasn't my job, but I loved giving people an extra pillow or a warm blanket or a cup of tea. You know, that was just real simple, wonderful thing to do. And yeah, I don't know. I guess that's not part of my, like being nice and whatnot. Seems easy for me, I guess. Like I like to be nice to people. So there's probably another part of compassion. I think having tolerance sometimes for things that irritate me, that actually came to me recently. Was something would have normally been irritating, and I was like, oh yeah, be tolerant, like just being tolerant, and it doesn't hurt me to do that, and it's becoming more natural, I think. But anyways, I feel like compassion and emptiness, it's probably like it's the heart of the practice, I think.
Me too. It's really, I mean, I think it's great that it's hard to talk about for all of us. You know, it means that it's working. It's working inside somewhere. And it doesn't matter if we never get to being able, maybe we should never get to the point where it's easy to talk about. I don't know. So.
Oh, okay.
David.
Yeah, loving, expressing love has never been hard for me to do. I often try not to overly express love because it makes other people uncomfortable, I find. I think because it's difficult for a lot of people, but it's really not hard for me to express love, except I think what I'm working with and have been working with is feeling myself, my body, inside my body. that's always been hard. But I think love is the point. Just the point of for me, for of life itself, and it sustains me in subtle ways. And without thinking about it, I wake up because of love every day. And I don't mind experiencing love through the sunlight in the morning, or just a flower, or someone else's heartbreak, and watching them crumble into and feeling it with them, or making a sacred space for myself or someone else. I think love is endless and boundless, and it outlives us, and it lives within us. You know, I've wiped asses of the people I love, and I lived through it and seen them naked and suffering. And I was with them, and it was hard, but it made me better. And I just think love is the point, and I think Zen is about love. So that's my thing for now.
The word that came up for me when I started thinking and asking you guys, the word that came up for me was connection. So I'm stopping.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be.